Is a someone I have huge respect for, has a great career. Look it up, because it'll take me all, I'm not going to go through all this crap, okay? You have to do some of the work. So anyway, Eric is a really terrific artist. He shows with Mulherrin Gallery, a great gallery in the Lower East Side. Shout out to Catherine Mulherrin. And he has done an incredible project where it's so, what he's done is reenact what Ankhuwara has done in a 3 month project. He devoted his entire life to this 3 month project. And we're going to hear about that. Eric must be crazy. I want to find out if it totally fucked with his head. That's what we're going to find out. And then after that, we're going to have Carla Gaines in the second half. And Carla just got married. That's what I'm excited about. I want to hear about that. But you know what? She really wants to talk about her art, because she's so good at it and she's so devoted to it. And she has like she's like the what is she? What is she, Eric? The assistant chairman of what is it? I have it down here.
I think she's the president of Pratt University or something.
Yeah, President Pratt, and she's good looking.
Well, too bad she's taken now.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Oh, I think I heard a laugh out there. Anyway, so we're going to talk to her, but before we get started, let's do the station ID. This is Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit on Friday from 2 to 3, and I'm coming to you from Radio Free Brooklyn, which is the best station in the tri-state area. It is so amazing and it's so growing. And the other shows on this station, I am so happy to actually be included in something like this. Like, I can't fucking believe it. And Tom and I still get along well. I spelled his name wrong, but we're over it. Oh yeah, and also my sponsor, which is Paul Mitchell Hair Care, which is a shampoo, so shampoo and conditioner. So if you are in the habit of washing your hair and using conditioner, it's a brand you could think of buying.
It's too bad they can't see how great our hair looks.
Well, we're gonna have pictures, don't worry. So let's get right down to it. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Dr. Lisa.
Oh, he's right here. This is so exciting. Live. So Eric, why don't you, because not everyone is familiar with Ankhuwara. I have like the list of things that you did to recreate what he did, but why don't you explain it, because you're closer into that. So tell us what the project is that you did.
Okay, sure. Well, I'll explain a little bit about Ankhuwara and his artwork first, I guess, for those who don't know him. Ankhuwara is an artist who was born in Japan but lived mostly in New York and who passed away last year. And he's best known for what's called the Today series, which is a series of paintings that he made for over 40 years. And each one is simply the date of a single day painted in white on a monochrome canvas, usually a very dark gray. And each painting was made on the day that's depicted. So if it says January 17th, 1969, it was made on that day. And they're painted in the language of wherever Ankhuwara was on the day that he made that painting. So if he was in France, it would have it in French and what have you. He also did a number of other projects kind of documenting his life. He did a project called I Went, which consisted of drawing in red pen on a map the path that he took every day. He did a project called I Got Up, where he would send out a postcard rubber stamped with the time that he woke up that day and also the location. And the postcard was, of course, from the same place. He did a project called I Met, which was a list of all of the people that he met. Again, kind of a daily list, and a project called I Read, which had to do with things that he read in the paper and kind of archived. So
if we were going to make a list of it, you would be saying that he made a painting every day?
well, not necessarily every
Or
day,
almost
but
every day?
more frequently at the beginning than later on, but
But like a painting roughly a day or
well,
every other day?
you know, I think the first few years he made probably over 200 paintings a year, and then in later years he did it a little bit less frequently. But each painting was made in only a day and on the day that is,
you know, presented. So anyway, he was busy painting away.
Right.
He was sending out postcards every day. He was writing down everything he read. He wrote down on a map everywhere he went. And he made a list of all the people he saw. Is that right? Every day?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And other than that, however, he led a very, I suppose you could say, mysterious life.
Oblique.
In that he never gave an interview. He did not allow himself to be photographed. He never spoke about his work in public. So he did all these things that documented some very minute details of his life and over a very long time span, but there are a lot of other things about him that are unknown to those of us who did not know him personally.
So it's kind of interesting because the facts about him are easily available, but the actual, I don't know, spirit or what his personality was like or is very... there's not very much known, right? I mean, it's hard to know. It's hard to get a sense of his personality outside of his artwork. Am I right? Does that make sense?
Well, he did. You know, he sort of did not. He led a very private life, I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, some things that, you know, kind of we know, like he really enjoyed games and puzzles, and apparently he actually supported himself in the early years through gambling. But yeah, you know, he at once kind of revealed, you know, very much about his life, and on the other hand, kept a lot very private. So going back to my project, just to let the listeners sort of know a little bit more about it, there was an exhibition for 3 months earlier this year at the Guggenheim Museum, which presented all of Ankara's different projects. He had the whole museum. And for that period of 3 months, I basically reenacted all of those projects that we just discussed. So I made, you know, roughly 3 paintings a week. I kept a daily list of everyone who I met. I drew a map every day of where I went and sent out the postcards with the time that I got up as well.
That sounds horrible. I mean, Eric, that just sounds like the most masochistic way to live, if you ask me.
It was pretty intense. It definitely took over my life.
So anyway, I want to talk about what that experience was like for you, because, you know, I remember I came by the studio like when it was done, and it was really, I asked you a lot of details about it, and I got a sense sort of what it was like, and I remember thinking that it was a very extreme experience, right? It sounded like it.
Yes.
Would you agree with that? Because it really just took over your entire life, every moment, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, you know, I wasn't painting every day, so I did have some time off in a sense. But at the same time, I was having to keep track of all of these things every day. Mm-hmm. And I also, I had a website for the project where I was posting everything. So I had to, you know, post things regularly.
Right. And a show at Mulhern throughout the whole process. So you had to, or most of it, a lot of it, the beginning, right?
The first month there was a show at Mulhern where, kind of, as I was making the paintings, I would also deliver them to the gallery more or less the next day.
Right. And, you know, the show was terrific. I'm sure it's still up online on the Mulhern website. But you were also dropping off the work, and the show was growing as you were going through the process of reenacting.
Right. It started with one painting, which I made on the first day of the project. And by the end of the show, I think there were 12 paintings, I believe.
And you didn't go to the opening.
That's right, because Ankara never went to his openings, never appeared in public. Mm-hmm. So I also, you know, basically went off of social media and didn't make any announced appearances over that time.
Oh, God, that must have been... that must have been tough, but
well, that I mean, that was
surprise
actually
appearances.
That was possibly one of the best parts. Was kind of
clearing, you know, your calendar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't have to, you know, write down, you know, all these things.
So anyway, that was finished. What, a month ago? 2 months ago?
It finished at the very beginning of May.
So let's talk about what that was like. How you look back on it? How it affected you? What the experience was like?
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I did have some sense of what I was getting into, because I had done some of those projects previously. So I had already been making the date paintings, you know, kind of for a few years, but not with the same frequency, of course. In 2010, I did the I Went project for a year, so I had a year's worth of maps that I had done. I had sent out the I Got Up postcards also for a year or two. So I had done these various things separately, but I had never done them all together at the same time. And, you know, my work in general is about remaking work by other artists. And so I was really interested with this particular project because, you know, I really felt like I was kind of inhabiting the world of Onquara and living my life in a very similar way, although of course, you know, he was dead, but while he was alive, you know, we got up in different places, we met different people. So within each day, there were, of course, differences about how we were going about our day, but it was kind of getting the whole experience of what it was like to be doing all these things simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been, what was that like? Was that the first time where, like, because you've also done things like Andy Warhol screen tests, you've remade those. And although that's a process that must sort of evoke what Andy Warhol must have gone through, I don't think you ever done a project this extreme of what it's like to do the other person's work?
Yeah, I mean, definitely nothing that was so extensive, you know, like this, because it was, you know, 3 months. And like you said, it was basically having to do something every day. It was certainly more, you know, intense and kind of a more prolonged, you know, meditation, yes, I guess, on it.
Right.
And, you know, it was also, I mean, it was, I think, really nice for me that there's also this exhibition up at the Guggenheim at the same time, because I also was able to spend a lot of time with the original artwork over this period and attend some lectures where there were other people, you know, talking about it who had really, you know, given it a lot of thought. But I also felt like I had a really kind of unique viewpoint on what it was like to actually be, you know, making these things or living your life in this way. And, you know, I have to say that I think one of the things, I mean, there were a number of surprises, but one of the big ones was really just about how kind of relentless it was, you know. And it's like, on the one hand, I was freed from having to make a lot of choices about, like, oh, when I go to the studio, what am I going to make today? You know, that was kind of decided for me. Mm-hmm. But there really was never really a break. I mean, I could take a few days off from painting, but I was still having to keep track of all these things, remember to write things down, remember to post them. And, you know, I think that was an aspect that, just looking at his work, I had never really appreciated the fact that just it was kind of unending. And, you know, in a way, you never escape from it.
Right. So I saw you maybe once or twice. You looked exhausted. I mean, what did it feel like? Like, was it exhausting? Were you in a surreal experience? Did you feel connected to Onquara? Let me just throw all those questions at you.
Sure. Well, it was physically fairly demanding. I mean, you know, I had set myself a goal of making about 2 or 3 paintings a week, but, you know, I also knew that I had some flexibility there because there wasn't a set schedule that I had to make them on. So if I was just totally tired or what have you, I could take the day off. You know, actually making the paintings, for me took quite a while. I mean, that was anywhere from, you know, 14 to 16 hours of work basically to make them.
For one painting, wow.
They're very precise and very smooth, and, you know, so it's just a lot of back and forth again.
Not easy to do. I couldn't make, I don't have the skills. You really have to have skills. It's true.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, actually by the end of it, it started really affecting my eyes. I mean, that was like a physical outcome that I felt. They started getting blurry really easily. And I actually, like, the project ended on May 3rd, and I really wanted to make 2 paintings in May, but at the end I was kind of unsure if I was gonna, you know, be able to do that without ruining my eyes.
Wow.
And I looked online, and sort of the website said, oh, your eyes should go back to normal, it'll be okay. So I decided to just push through it and do those. But I have noticed that still, you know, I do have problems when I'm doing that kind of focused close-up work for a while where they start to get blurry. And
interesting. So did you get any kind of like spiritual connection, whatever that means, spiritual? But I mean, did you feel like there was something, did you feel like you got an understanding of Onquara that you don't think that maybe anyone else would be able to get in any other way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, I mean, he was a very secretive person, and there's a lot about him that we don't know. So I didn't feel like I got closer to him in that sense. It's not that I learned, you know, these things about him in that way, but I think having the experience of, you know, of making these things and these works and doing them all together, you know, I guess more than some of the other artists who have kind of worked with, I did feel like I was kind of more walking in his shoes, as it were. And you know, another thing that was kind of a surprise is Angkor himself traveled quite extensively, and so these paintings were made all over the world, and the maps were, you know, all different places and what have you. I traveled a little bit over those 3 months, not nearly as extensively as he would have typically, but that was it was interesting actually how different the experience of making the paintings was when I went to different places.
Interesting.
And you know, I think when you look at them in a museum, I mean, you see the difference in, you know, the format or the languages of the dates, but somehow that had never really come across to me just as a viewer of thinking about like, oh, you know, like who, you know, this one he made in Japan when he was staying with his, you know, parents, or this one he made while he was you know, living in Mexico City for a month. And for myself, you know, the paintings that actually stick out a lot more to me when I look at them are the ones that I made while I was not in my studio, while I was somewhere else. And I have a lot more, you know, memories like, oh, that was, you know, when I, you know, had dinner with this person, or, you know, somehow coming out of the studio to make the work, made it, you know, those pieces more memorable to me. And, you know, I know that that doesn't come through to the viewer, but at the same time, you know, I think it is there in the work. And you know, also thinking about the I met and this list of people that he met, you know, and it's, you know, also presumably he probably gave paintings to people, and I, you know, have given some away too. And there is that kind of connection there with like, oh, someone, you know, was there with you in, you know, Dallas while you were making this painting, and also has kind of a connection with it.
What was it like functioning in the world? I mean, you were talking about like how you did travel a bit, and you had to set up shop, I'm guessing, in other places, and you know, and I'm sure like there must have been a point. I mean, you have the lovely Cathay, sorry, I'm on air, I got nervous, who must have been with you for, I mean, for part of it, right, at certain points. I mean, you guys don't live together, but you see each other regularly, and I imagine she was on some of the trips and stuff like
Yeah, she
that.
came along with some of them, sure.
Yeah, and then you guys were also around other people. So how awkward was that? Was that like weird? Like, sorry, I gotta write. I see you guys. I'm just gonna go write this list now. Or like, what was it like? Or like, were you ever in a situation where you were having to paint? Like, in you know, hey, do you mind if I gotta go paint for like 10 hours? Or like, what did you run across any of that?
I would say it was actually the opposite. You know, everyone who I stayed with while I traveled, obviously, I told about the project ahead of time, and you know, so they were aware of kind of what was going to be happening. And I actually felt like I was able to kind of share something about myself and my artistic process.
Oh,
And you
wow.
know, I think, you know, typically while you're working, you're in the studio, you're by yourself, there's kind of no one else around. And you know, you kind of present this thing at the end of it, and people look at it and they love it or they hate it. But I actually, you know, felt like it was a really nice thing to be able to make these things with other people around, and you know, like chat with them while I was painting instead of just having the radio on. And I sort of felt like it was a nice way of letting friends and family kind of know a little bit more of what,
You
you know,
do.
what my life is like.
And also, I guess they just by the nature of being in your sphere, were incorporated into the work as
That's right. So
well.
they would show up on the I Met project, and you know, any places that we went together would be on the map. And yeah.
And then when you look back on making the paintings, you probably think, oh, you remember, like they're like little souvenirs almost of what where you were,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. And each painting comes in a box with a newspaper from the
Right.
place where it was, you know, where it was made. So, and from the day when it was made. So there's also that kind of, you know, what was happening in the world, where was I? All those things definitely, you know, are right there in the work.
Right. So do you think that Angkor traveling a lot made making I mean that work sounds really difficult to make. It doesn't sound I have to say it doesn't sound enjoyable to me. But do you think that him traveling might have made it a lot more enjoyable? Like he traveled a lot. Do you think that traveling made it just like more How is it fucking tenable to do that? And how was it tenable for him to do that?
Well, I think first of all, we have to assume that, there was something in his personality that liked doing this kind of
And
work.
what do you think that
And
is?
well, I don't want to be stereotypical, but he was, of Japanese
Oh,
descent. He was
yeah.
born in Japan, and we often
Asian.
associate with Japanese people this kind of precision and simplicity and,
Stereotypes. Yeah, I get it. No, it makes sense, though.
So there is that, and I think that's something that I was definitely working against in a way. I mean, not that I, can't do something that's precise and meticulous, but my, let's just say, if I was going to make these paintings, I would have gone about it a little bit differently, and I would have, just taken a different approach. So it was something that was, in a sense, not natural to me in the same way that it would have been a natural outgrowth of what he was doing. But I think that the travel was definitely a part of it, and something that certainly I thought about is, it's like I'm drawing this map of where I went every day, and I'm keeping this list of who I met every day, and I sort of like to think about how all those people that I met had their own maps of where they went
Oh,
that
that's
day,
interesting.
and all of our maps would kind of intersect and
Oh, that's so
diverge
interesting.
in
Yeah,
different
and
places, and
so
like
interesting.
if I had lunch with a couple, like much of their path would have been the same, but then maybe they, went, one went home and took a nap, and one went out to a museum or something like that. And so I really like to think about how these things connect and depart, and then also, with the postcards, those are kind of, also fanning out across the
Yeah, I've got a
world.
bunch, thank God. And I've got a bunch from before. That's my retirement right
Yeah.
there. So you said there were some surprises. Are there any other surprises that I might not have asked you about that you would share?
Let's see. We talked about the relentlessness of the days. We talked about the travel.
Did I ask all the right questions and get them all out? I hope so. That would be great. Testament to me. Yay me.
We should have made a list beforehand.
No, that's so Anquara-y. You're
Right.
actually, I want my listeners to know that Eric, by nature, you seem to be out of the people I know, you seem to be one of the most organized artists that I personally know. So I think that, I just want my listeners to know. It's not like you were starting. I mean, you would say you're organized, right? But
I think that's safe to say,
yeah, highly organized, right?
I wouldn't have taken on this project if I thought it was something that I couldn't do, or that, or if it was totally against my nature. But there is something about kind of inhabiting someone else's shoes that it's a weird thing. It's like you're kind of, in some ways they don't fit quite right. They rub on the toe or something like that.
So anyway, this is really as much, I think we'd all have to say it's pretty much a performance as much as it is making the art, right?
Yeah, it definitely was, a performance, and I think also obviously time is a major theme in Angkor's work, with this kind of recording of the days, and I guess I was also interested in that, and having this website, which, by the way, if anyone wants to go, it's still up. It's echoes2015.tumblr.com.
Yeah, it's fascinating, by the way. I was looking at it this morning.
But
It's really well
that's
done.
kind of this update that, for, I mean, at the end of Angkor's life, the internet was there, but for most of it, this didn't exist. But, I would think that had it been there, maybe he would have had a blog or been tweeting this information or something like that. And, and if we think about the sort of technology that he was working with, he did a whole project which using telegrams, which actually I couldn't really do because you can't send a telegram anymore. And even something like postcards, which I think, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you could have easily bought wherever you went. Nowadays it's actually kind of hard to find a postcard when you go someplace. And so that was sort of interesting to me too, how like the postcard and the telegram were these things that were very much of his time and sort of doing it now. It's with, you know, Tumblr and the internet as well, kind of making it more a project of my time.
So what kind of profound is there, like, when, like, has it made any, now that we're, now that it's a month or two months away or whatever it is there any changes that you think it's affected you in the long term?
I mean, we talked about my eyes, which I'm hoping will not be completely long term.
Psychological.
You know, I mean, I think anything that you do, you know, affects you. I mean, I definitely felt like I needed to take some time and recuperate from it and sort of think about what I wanted to do next. It was, you know, I think because I spent a number of months planning this project and then 3 months doing it so intently, I didn't really have anything set up
right,
in the works
you
to do
planned
afterwards.
It. Yeah.
So that's sort of been interesting to me about thinking about what, you know, comes next. And I think, you know, with all of my work, although it's, you know, always kind of working with something that's been done by another artist first, there's also usually some element of autobiography in it.
Right, of course.
You know, and that I think, you know, is very prevalent in this project, but also I've been thinking more about that, you know, going forwards and kind of how, I mean, obviously, in some ways, all art is autobiographical, but kind of how you know, I might do more to kind of incorporate my own self and my own experiences and my own kind of personal history into these works that I might make.
Oh,
in the
wow!
Future.
So that's really interesting. So that so wow, that's a really interesting effect that it had. Kind of, does that feel like it's opening?
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like that's something that's totally new. You know, I think that definitely there are projects I've done before that kind of played with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I guess
it highlighted that area.
Yeah, it made me think more about kind of working in that space a little bit in the future.
Interesting. But the question I was going to ask you next—it's actually going to be our last question, I think. Is sort of leading into that because I was wondering if you were thinking about doing any other kind of work that is more performative or more integrated into your life. And, I mean, is this another, which is kind of what you're saying, you know, kind of relates to what you're saying.
Or, yeah, I mean, I'm
would
not...
you do this again, you nut?
I would probably not do this. Again, I mean, I have made a few paintings since the project.
No, but I mean,
but not
another similar thing or another
I think you know, I mean, performance has been in some ways an aspect of my work in the past. Like I used to sell these little bootleg paintings on the street, and part of it was not just making the paintings, but kind of the act of selling them. So. It's something that I am interested in. You know, I would never call myself a performance artist. I think I'm much more interested in...
Don't do that anyway. Just don't even say it.
I think I'm more interested in the object. But, but, you know, I think this question of autobiography and kind of how to incorporate that into the work, you know, I mean, that, you know, even if it's a painting that somehow is about its creation or about its... Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. I mean, I think that there are ways to bring that in.
Well, I'm excited. I mean, I thought the project was fascinating the whole time you were doing it. I was just so curious, and I don't know of anyone has done that's anything like it, which is so interesting to hear about. And I'm excited to see what you're going to do next. All the pressure's on now. We're all going to, everyone out there, just keep at. If you see Eric on the street, just ask him, what are you doing next? And I want to give your lovely girlfriend, Cathay, a shout-out because I adore her.
Thank you.
Say hi. Hi, Cathay. Is she listening?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, she's probably going to hear this at some point.
Probably.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Eric.
Thanks, Lisa.
Let's get our next guest, Carla, in here. Carla Gaines. Get her in here, Eric. Tell her to move her butt quickly. Get in here now. And while she's getting in here, you guys can say hello and goodbye.
Hello,
oh, wait,
goodbye.
Eric, I want to take your...
I'll come back. I'm just going to step back.
Okay. I got a little nice note. It says, hey, say hi to Carla from me, from Tom Tenney. I didn't know you know him.
Oh, hi.
Okay, sit down.
All right.
Let's do the station ID again, because Tom Tenney, the co-director of... Yeah, put him right on. The co-director of Brooklyn Radio Free Brooklyn. Radio Free Brooklyn, coming to you from Bushwick. And I'm really glad to be here. Dr. Lisa gives a shit. And I give a shit about Carla. I have for a long time. And I still give a shit. So I don't know if it's done you any good. But I give a shit about you.
That's special.
It is special.
I sat on your lap. And I have also been on your couch. Uh-huh.
Can you move a little closer to the mic?
Yes.
Is your mic on? Yeah, your mic's on.
Can everyone hear me?
Everyone can hear you.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Turns out Tom Tenney was listening. How about that, huh?
Super. Hi, Tom.
How do you know Tom?
I know so many people.
I keep forgetting about that. Yeah. Carla knows everybody.
Context.
Because Carla is lovely, gorgeous, outgoing, talented. I don't know. Just so many things. Oh, but let me introduce you to Carla, because Carla just came back from getting married in Italy, which is so freaking romantic. I tried to convince her to just go through every detail of her getting married and everything, like the dress, the flowers, how it went, how it felt. But, you know, I don't think it's like, I think she, you know, she was just like, I don't know. You know, she told me to buy a bride's magazine. Okay, that's what she said. but you know what, if you don't know Carla's latest work, I think it's your latest work or one of your most visible works lately that's been shown, is the Garden Emoji Delights, which is like such an amazing work. And I'm sure you can see it on Carla's website, right?
Yeah.
And that's up at the Hudson River Museum until
September 27th.
And she has a show coming up in Bushwick, a bunch of shows. She's always busy. And where's the show on Saturday?
So that's going to be at Transfer Gallery. And it's actually, I'm part of a show curated by Faith Holland, who has a solo show there right now. Oh. And it's a collection of 40 gifts that she's curated about gifts to have sex by. So I think it's going to be a fantastic show. And it was supposed to be the closing party for her show, but her show has now been extended because it's been getting so much press. So I'm giving a shout out for Faith Holland and Transfer Gallery right
now. Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. And that's your gallery as well. And you're going to have a solo show there in January.
Yes.
Very exciting. When's the opening? Tomorrow?
So Faith's, the group show is tomorrow. That's part of her solo show.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll stop by.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
I got it on my calendar. Very okay. So, anyway, and you were also. What's your title?
I like that I was promoted. I was listening to the Eric's interview while I was outside, and I like that I was promoted to president of Pratt. But I'm actually the assistant chairperson of digital arts, and so that's a department at Pratt Institute.
Wow. See, you've got it, and you just got married. Oh my God. Carla, you should be giving out the advice for God. Just give us advice. What are we doing? What am I doing wrong, Carla?
Lol, that's all I have to say.
Okay. That's laugh out loud. I even got that. Is that how everybody in the digital arts department talks now?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
FOMO, lol. Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to talk about your childhood, because this is Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I wanted to know, like, I thought it would be really inspiring, because you're so accomplished, to find out what your childhood was like and how art was part of it and all that. So let's do that. You're good with that?
Sure. I wish I were laying on your couch right now to discuss this. I'll preface it with one thing, because you were mentioning the marriage and my getting married in Italy and that was very romantic, etc. How did you know about it? Via social media. And I am very active on social media. And recently I was at a dinner party and I was talking to some people and I said, I'm shy. And they were like, you're kidding me. You are not shy. And it's really funny, because I was a very shy child when I was quite young. And I think I've spent my adulthood overcompensating. So I'm very active on social media. And, you know, even the wedding, there was a performative aspect to it. No doubt it's, you know, a commitment to the person that I married, Cleveland. But also, you know, we had...
Who's adorable.
But but we had it in an art and performance space. And you know, that's something, you know, my entire life has been pretty committed to art since I was very young.
Yeah.
And so it only seemed right for us to commit to each other in an art and performance space in Bologna. And so now back to my childhood. I grew up in a really small town in the South. That's one other reason I will add that I think Cleveland and I work so well together, because he's also from a small town in the South.
Ah.
He's from Alabama. I'm from North Carolina. So I grew up in this really small town of about 7,000 people. And by third grade, I worked with my grandfather to make a model of New York City. So I had aspirations early.
But what did your father do?
My father was in computing, doing nonlinear video editing.
What?
Yeah, so my mother was a Cher lookalike model when I was a kid.
Get out. Did I know that? A Cher lookalike model?
Yeah, she's
like, she made a money impersonating Cher?
Yeah, yeah.
Holy shit.
She's a diva. And she used to pick me up from school in different wigs. She, like, performed her identity a lot. This is all before social media, right? And she wasn't an artist, but that performative aspect, I think, is something that is, you know, kind of encoded in my DNA. And both of my parents are artistic, I'll say that. And, you know, we used to, instead of watching TV, we'd sit around and make drawings and paintings together. But neither of them, coming from the South and coming from these very small towns, felt like it was an endeavor that they could pursue. But they encouraged me, and thankfully. And mm-hmm. so since I was really young, you know, it was a way I expressed myself. Something else, you know, I'll mention, because this was something that I was very insecure about when I first moved to New York, and I've now been in New York 20 years as of this May.
Oh, wow.
So I feel like I can now, you know, proclaim I'm a New Yorker, although I still smile at everyone on the street. You can take the girl out of the South, but you can't take the South out of the girl. But, you know, there's something else that has impacted me greatly, and a few years ago, I finally reconciled two identities in a way. The New Yorker Carla, the person who really tried to assimilate, and then the Carla who grew up in this really small southern town, and also half of my family is from the Appalachian Mountains. And, you know, there's a family homestead, and, you know, we'd go up there and visit my relatives. My grandmother and grandfather are both Appalachian.
Family homestead. So is that, like, I mean, I was, I don't know, like, my, you know, I'm just picturing, like, kids with no shoes and
yeah,
no plumbing.
Yeah, I mean, those are the presumptions. Those are the presumptions.
Well, what was it like, how you were?
And actually, the family homestead, it was like going back in the 19th century, because there was no plumbing. There was an outhouse. There were those things.
So did you grow up with no plumbing?
No, I did not. And I want to make sure this is correct, because recently I was interviewed and someone was like, she grew up in Appalachia. No, that's my mother's family. And so we were very close to them, and we'd go visit every summer and stay up there. And as a child, I loved it because it was this bucolic landscape. And then as I grew older, I started to realize that there were a lot of presumptions made about people there, and class assumptions,
of course,
and all of these things. And so then, you know, by the time I got to New York, I was really scared to talk about that part of my identity, although mm-hmm. it had been so significant to me as a child.
Sure.
Most of my family, they're storytellers. My grandfather made musical instruments. He made violins, dulcimers, and banjos. And he and my grandmother would sing mountain ballads. And my mother and I would sing them sometimes at festivals my grandfather would be at, and these kind of things. And so there was a performative aspect there, too. But also a lot of that culture, you know, that kind of storytelling, those kind of things, you know, definitely have surfaced in my work. I often describe myself as a digital storyteller, and I also say that I came from the Gothic South, and now I'm more interested in exploring themes of, you know, instead of Southern Gothic, Internet Gothic. Per se.
You know? That's a funny term.
But, you know, I mention these things now just because I think sometimes when people first move to New York, and particularly within the art world, it's just like, you know, Gannis, for example, is not my last name. I was inspired by Andy Warhol, Philip Guston, all of these people.
Is that, what was your real last name?
Well, I'm not going to say that, although my parents, of course, will hear this radio station and they'll be like, say your last name. But, you know,
I'm getting the sense that you were, were you embarrassed? Is that
no? I don't think I was ever embarrassed, but I do think that sometimes when you come to New York and you have, you know, aspirations, you're like, I want to be an artist, and you meet all of these people who are super hip and they've grown up in New York City, or they're just like more of aware of things.
Sophisticated,
you know?
Sophisticated. In quotes.
I had a thick Southern accent, you know, and I was like, well, I'm in New York now and I can be whoever I want to be, you know. And I used to actually have this alter ego in the 90s, Sister Gemini, and I did work through her, and she, you know, and I spoke through, I've had several different kind of mm-hmm. identities and things like that. And I think I'm really interested in exploring identity and mm-hmm. kind of the politics involved with that. Mm-hmm. And so being forthright, I think when I first moved here, I was like, oh God, people won't understand where I come from. Or, you know, I was self-conscious that I'd be considered a hick, or I'd be considered, you know, mm-hmm. not up to snuff. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that it takes a while sometimes, you know, for whatever reasons, to kind of come into yourself. And I've done right. that, I think, through my art.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, you're clearly, you are you in such a clear way. I don't, I mean, you can't put words, put it into words and define it, but you are you. Do you think that some of that identity issue might have had to do with your mother being a share? Like, what was that like? Reenactor. Like Eric reenacting on Kawara, your yeah. mother. No, but I mean, do you think, like, was that confusing to you as a child at all? Was that weird? How did you digest that as a child?
Well, when I was a child, one, you know, that we were growing up. And I say growing up because I'm an only child. My mother was very young when she had me. So I always say
How
that
old?
We were growing up together. She was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Did she go to college or high school?
She went to high school, but she didn't go to college. Yeah.
Did she have plumbing when she grew up?
And she did. Mm-hmm. It was my grandparents
okay.
who didn't. And it was
okay.
the homestead.
So she
yeah.
was like, yeah. So that's she was yeah. pretty normal in a lot
yeah,
of ways.
Yeah, no, totally normal. It's, you know, and it was just that, you know, there was this retreat in the mountains, and we still have the homestead there and land and things like that. And it was an amazing experience for me because my life has been like time travel. You know, there was one part or aspect of my identity and my family that was kind of posited in the 19th mm-hmm. century. Then my dad was into computing and taking me to computer
right.
graphics festivals, you know, and so I was jettisoning into the 21st century, you mm-hmm. know, at the end of the 20th.
And you're also like a very physical person, you know, you present as very athletic, mm-hmm. and I know you are. So do you think some of that is from growing up and being outside and all that stuff, being in the country?
Well, that's something else. My mother was, you know, she was very young and when I was born, and then, you know, we grew up together, and she is a very charismatic person. And she saw that I was shy, so she put me in lots of lessons so that I would become comfortable in my body. And, you know, running was something that I liked a lot because it was a more solitary endeavor. So I've
You're such an
run.
Artist. Such an artist.
But, I, you know, so I have her to thank for that, to, you know, in terms of being comfortable in my body and being physical, you know, because she put me in dance mm-hmm. and all of those different things you put little girls in. And she was also very physical, and she ran and danced too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But she also, you know, was exploring identity early on, and it was something that I was observing, and also that she was, you know, Cher, she's exotic, and in the South, you know, there's this tendency for a lot of people, you know, to look at someone like my mother. The question we'd always get was, are you Italian or are you from New York?
Yeah,
you know,
right,
since
right.
I was a little child, it was always like, where are you from? You know, and those kind of things, you know, in terms of positionality, I think influenced me and my decisions to move to New York, for one, you know.
Right,
yeah.
right. So did your mom like sing and do all that, or where would she appear?
Yeah, no, this was mostly, and this was when I was little, this was mostly she'd be doing runway shows and things like this. And there was this guy who dressed up like Sonny. And when I was really small, I had blonde hair. And so,
Chastity?
Yeah.
You were Chastity?
I was.
Do you have
I
any pictures
up on
like
stage
that?
Once. Yeah.
Could you send us some so we could post them? I mean, if you want, you don't have to, but
maybe,
we would
yeah,
love it.
Yeah.
We would love it here at Radio Free Brooklyn. Brooklyn Free Radio. Brooklyn Free Radio.
Yeah.
Radio Free Brooklyn. I always, oh man, I think I've got dyslexia. But like, did you see Cher on TV? I got stuck on this. Sorry, I got to get this out.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Cher on TV?
Oh, yeah, I did.
So did you ever think, like, how did you resolve, like, your mom being Cher and that being Cher? What did you think? Like, what did you think as a little girl?
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, I always knew she was my mother and that was Cher. I was able to kind of make those distinctions.
Right.
One, because Sonny was, you know, this short guy, and my uh-huh. dad's 6'5",
but,
and didn't look like Sonny.
But was there ever, like, part of you that just wished your mom was the real Cher?
Probably. There was also a part of me at some point, and, you know, my mother loved road trips. We had a Fiat convertible, and she'd take road trips all the time, and so I grew up kind of in that car. And finally, when I was in second grade, you know, the principal called my mother in and said, you got to keep your girl in school, you know, because she just loved, she's a very free spirit, you know.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that, too, because I think that's something that's driven me as well in terms of, you know, the way I've lived my life.
She sounds so awesome.
I mean, I'm now married, but, you know, I've never even owned a bed. I'm a person who's roamed and I don't collect. I collect computers and art and costumes sometimes because I've used myself in my work quite a bit.
Yeah.
But other things and, you know, the household. And those kind of domesticity isn't really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think, you know, I was influenced by my mother in that way, too. But I was able to tell she wasn't Cher. But the other thing I mentioned was, you know, she had other identities, too. You know, and she'd model and do these things. And at the time, it was the 70s, so women were wearing wigs and these things. So she had this collection of wigs. She'd pick me up from school in a wig based on who she felt like for the day. And I think later, you know, I've used myself on and off in my work for over 10 years, 15 years. And I think that, again, is something that, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I can look at now and say, probably at 6 and 7 years old, my mother, you know, dressing up and performing the, you know, these different
identities. That's so great.
Has influenced what I do.
So did you see identity as a child as mutable in a way?
I did see it as mutable because my mother also would get dressed up in mountain wear and we'd perform with my grandfather with banjos and dulcimers, you know, and then she could be very cosmopolitan and looking like Cher, you know, and I felt like that even my own identity where I'm listening to these 19th century mountain ballads sung by my grandmother that are woeful and, you know, talking about the despair of humanity and then going to a computer graphics conference with my dad talking about the future and everything's whiz bang, you know, I felt like my own identity was mutable within that. And of course, I didn't have the words to articulate it at the time. I just had this drive to, you know, accomplish things and make art and make my way to the Northeast. That was a kind of big thing for me.
And you went to college out here? Is that when you
came to grad school in Boston University.
Right, but that was like when
Did
you go to college at home?
Yeah, I went to college down south, UNC Greensboro.
Wow, So you're people are surprised when they hear this side of you. You seem, you know, Trey sophisticated. Right? I think so.
I guess that depends on the day too.
So you're a real self-made woman. Let's acknowledge that too, honey. You folks out there, you lazy fucking asses, get going. Look at what's happened here. So your dad sounds like he influenced the visual art, the actual making up things for you.
You know, it's really interesting. We had this reverse generation gap because when I was younger, I was making oil paintings and I studied classical piano for 12 years.
I didn't know that,
kind of classical. And I think one, because I was like, oh, well, serious artists paint. And my dad was saying to me then, you know, he's showing me Photoshop and showing me all of these different
really?
Programs.
Wow, as a kid.
Yeah,
wow.
And he's and he or I think it was Corel Draw was the first one.
Yeah.
And he's saying, this is the future of art. And, you know, I was resistant at first. And it's really interesting because it's your parent. You know, you're supposed to, like, I rebelled by painting. Wow, I'm such a rebellious young woman. But I think, you know, I was resistant at first. And later, I remember about 10 years ago, I got a grant for computer arts. And I remember, you know, telling my dad, you were right. I finally came around, you know. But, you know, I studied painting through grad school, oil painting, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's something else. There's a confluence of past and present and future that, you know, occurs in my work where a lot of times I'm, you know, working with new technologies. But I also am quoting or appropriating, like the Bosch piece, for example, mm-hmm. from the past. And I think that is something that, you know, is, again, just kind of encoded in me to see the world that way of these kind of overlapping times and finding convergences and divergences between past, present, and future.
Do you ever feel out of place in the world?
Sure.
We all do, but does it, like, you have so many facets, real facets, like in being from a place that's so different from most of the people around here, and, you know, knowing all about painting and digital stuff and growing up in that way, like, does that feel like you must have had to integrate a lot of different things because you're fairly different than your upbringing, right? Your parents?
Yeah.
And you're an only child?
I'm an only child.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have like a brother or a sister to be, you know, influenced by or share, like you didn't get any outside perspective of like what you were experiencing from
sure.
a peer.
Yeah. And that was one thing, you know, when I referred to the shyness when I was younger, I was much more comfortable in front of adults because the two kind of main people in my life were my parents, and mm-hmm. they both were relatively young and kind of free spirits at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while to kind of feel comfortable with people my own age. I think that I am always today, you know, in, mm-hmm. in kind of the position I'm in as an artist and as an academic, recalibrating, you know, who I am. I look back at my work sometimes and there are a few people who've talked to me about my work and they recognize that they're through lines, but I'm not a person who, it's interesting, we were talking about Ankuwara, for example, mm-hmm. and I think he's a fascinating artist.
Yeah.
I think he's particularly fascinating in the context of like internet mm-hmm. culture today.
Mm-hmm.
But like there's these certain artists who I went to the Mirandi Museum in Italy too, who have this persistence of vision throughout their lives.
Right.
It's one way of expressing themselves. And
right.
I've never been, you know, capable of doing that. I'm always kind of shape-shifting. And I mean, I think that is, you know, a hallmark of my work, that kind of shape-shifting, you know, in style and content somewhat too.
So there must be a lot of room for growth, personal growth in that way, I think, for you.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's
and
exciting.
That feels most comfortable to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're comfortable with things changing, which is such a gift in this planet.
Well, I think as a digital artist, being mutable is so important and necessary. And I call myself a digital artist. Sometimes mm-hmm. I call myself a transmedia artist. Sometimes I just call myself an artist, whatever. But, you know, there are all these monikers. But I think one who is working with technology has to get used to things changing. Because we're constantly dealing with obsolescence. I have a storage unit upstate New York mm-hmm. Filled with all of this obsolete technology that I can't let go of. So all these old computers and discs and things
Also
the only way to play certain things. I still have video works on VHS tape. My God.
It's good to know because, you know, maybe sometime I'll need to borrow.
Some obsolete
technology. I have some obsolete stuff, too.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and your parents, are they good? They sound like really amazing, interesting people.
Yeah, they're awesome.
And also it sounds like they did a great job of letting you know, be you.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of parents, I think that's such a great, important. I also want to point out here that, you know, having a lot of happiness in your childhood and a good relationship with your parents can lead to productive, creative work. This is a great example of that you don't need to be miserable and hang on to your neuroses to make great work. I just want you all to, like, take note here, because I'm feeling inspired by Carla and reminded of that myself. So we've got about 8 minutes left, and I want to get my bridal magazine thrills. So I'm going to ask you guys got married in Italy.
We got married in Bologna. So we took a trip. And it was about 10 days. Oh, I have actually a kind of interesting anecdote to share with you, too. So we had a layover in Moscow because we mm-hmm. both had never been to Moscow. And so I'm going to get to the wedding part.
Yeah, I promise.
But
okay, we got 7 minutes.
Okay. And so our visa was rejected. So when we got to Moscow, we rented this really fancy hotel that had a pool and a gym and this nice restaurant. And we were like, well, you know, we'll have 14 hours. We don't get to go to Red Square because we don't have a visa, but at least we'll get to enjoy the amenities of this hotel. No, they locked us in a room. They take you up a back staircase. There are these agents. They look like something out of the Matrix. And then these beautiful women with their hair swept up in long coats. And they take you up this back elevator. And then they lock you in a room. They give you room service. And then they come get you to take you away in the bus back to the airport. It was a really kind of
fascinating
experience.
Were you frightened?
I was a little, you know. And there are also surveillance cameras everywhere. And by the way, because I have lots of Russian friends, I am not in any way trying to denigrate. It was a fascinating experience because, you know, we were silly to not, you know, try to get the visa earlier, but they wouldn't do it because we were doing Moscow, Italy, so, New York.
Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, right.
And so that was kind of a fascinating experience.
That's
then
crazy.
We went to the Venice Biennale and we had a lot of fun there. And
I
we've
saw
been doing
photos.
A series together, alone together. So we photographed ourselves alone in places and then I photoshopped them together.
That's adorable.
And then we went to Verona as well, fair city where Shakespeare placed Romeo and Juliet, and then also Bologna. And so a good friend of mine that I've known for years, Stefano Pasquini, an artist, fantastic artist, organized the event for us. And we had about 40 people there. It was great.
I saw pictures.
Yeah. And it was at this performance art space. And so it was billed as kind of like a wedding art performance. And we had three children who were our ring bearer. I love fanny packs. Anyone who knows me knows me.
That's true.
A collection of fanny packs.
That's true.
So we had a fanny pack bearer. And I also have this fixation on Wonder Woman. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we know
that
about that.
So we had two superhero heroine capes. And so we had capes put on, and then, our rings, and we fist bumped with the rings, and then my fanny pack, my magic gold fanny pack. So
I want to see that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That sounds
so. So it wasn't a conventional traditional wedding.
No.
I don't think it's going to be written about in Bride magazine.
No, you're right. So you said that you were surprised when Cleveland asked you to marry him.
Yeah.
I can't even fucking say it. And it was fairly spontaneous for you, right?
It was like a month ago,
you said?
And we had only been dating for 5 months.
So how did it happen? I want to hear the story.
And it was actually our 5 month anniversary.
Oh.
Yeah. And we were just sitting there talking about the future, and he asked me, and I looked at him, and I was, at first I was like, is he serious? Is this a big joke?
So will you marry me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
Will you marry me?
Yeah.
Whoa. How did you feel? Like, did you just go like, whoa, I got a pot press? Like, how did you feel?
Yeah, at first I was like, I've got to process it. That took about 3 seconds. And I mean, and it's fascinating because I think sometimes, we think about relationships and we think about standards. We think about, a relationship takes this long to grow and this long to develop. And there should be, a timeline that, for these things. But sometimes when you meet someone, and I think particularly because he kind of understands parts of my nature that a lot of other people from here might not, and the fact that he comes from Monroeville, Alabama.
That makes a lot of sense.
The literary capital of Alabama.
Is that right?
And this really small town. And when we first met, actually, this was really funny because it's become, kind of like this like badge for me. I come from this tiny town in the South, 7,000. He said, well, mine's 5,000. and I was crestfallen. And he's an architect, and he and actually the building that I work in at Pratt, his firm built, so
that's how you met.
Nice. Yeah. And but it's really interesting when you meet someone, and he had aspirations when he was very young too to move to New York City, and he also worked on losing his Southern accent because there is this kind of presumption that you're not as smart if your accent is too thick and those kind of things. And so we have a lot of shared experiences.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And also, you guys are past the post-college stage. And
considerably.
You have but you have life experience, which, a lot of times, you know yourself. You've obviously been a lot of different Carlas, so you know yourself.
Yeah.
And so where were you sitting when he asked you? Like, where was it? You really surprised? Where was it?
It was actually in his architecture firm.
In the office?
Yeah.
In between meetings?
Not in between meetings, though. Yeah, it was in the conference room. And so, yeah, it was...
In the conference room.
It was,
Did he say, come on in, I want to have a meeting, I've got an issue I want to discuss?
Yeah.
We've got to talk about...
It was on my Google Calendar and, Google Calendar and,
Did they have any...
I texted him first and, and I texted my response, of course. I made sure I just texted him, my response. I didn't want to, speak
right.
it or
and
anything.
And they had some, account people there to help steer the meeting, make sure the agenda got covered
of
and
course.
Stuff. So, did you said yes right away, or how long does it take to compute something like that? What is that like?
You're were married. You know,
I have such a different road.
I've got to interview you and hear that story.
Now, my road is nothing like yours at all. I am very happily married. My husband is terrific, guy.
He certainly is.
I've got a whole other, that's why I'm doing this radio show, because eventually if I get to do like 100 of, I'm not fucking talking about it, okay? We don't have time for what happened to me. My husband's great. That's all. I'm happily married. That's all I want. That's all I need to say right now. But so we're going to have to quit. We're going to have to finish. So what happened there? How did you compute it? Did you like go through your head and then you went, yay, great?
Yeah.